Many of us suffer from or know someone who suffers from an allergic or autoimmune disorder like asthma, Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, and food and pollen allergies. Over the last few decades, the prevalence of these diseases has increased dramatically in this country, which leads to the question, why have our immune systems started to malfunction in this way? Science journalist Moises Velasquez-Manoff set out to find out why, and the result is his book, An Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases. It's published by Scribner. Moises Velasquez-Manoff was here in October, and because so many people are affected by allergies and other autoimmune disorders, and because a lot of new research is being done in the field, we're rebroadcasting that interview. I began by asking him, do you suffer from any allergies or have autoimmune disorders?
Absolutely. I have. I've had food allergies to peanuts and sesame for as long as I can remember. I've had asthma. And beginning around 11 years of age, I was struck by an autoimmune disorder called alopecia areata, which basically meant that I ended up completely hairless, as you can see.
Yeah. And does anybody know what triggers that?
No, I mean, there's lots of theories. It's an autoimmune disorder in the sense that your immune system has turned on your hair follicles and sort of, they're still there, interestingly enough, but they're dormant. They're permanently asleep because of this ongoing sort of interference in the hair growth cycle.
Are there links between the different autoimmune disorders?
Yes, many of them share. So there are genes. There are gene variants that are associated with autoimmune disorders, and many of them share the same variants. And actually, in 2010, a scientist published sort of one of these studies looking at alopecia areata specifically, and there were a lot of these so-called susceptibility alleles, or just these versions of genes that were shared with other autoimmune disorders.
So if this is a genetic situation, then why have we seen such a major increase? How many people currently suffer from these problems, and how does it compare to 50 or 150 years ago?
Well, so about 5 to 8% of Americans suffer from an autoimmune disorder. And the reason the genes are now causing these problems is really the subject of the book. But my argument is that these genes did not cause these problems in an environment that resembles our evolutionary past.
So we've changed the world, and now we're triggering them. This is not really just a matter of better diagnosis?
No. There's some very good studies, for example, with celiac disease, where they have stored serum. So this is diagnosed by certain antibodies. And they have stored serum going back 50 years or something, and they look at that serum, and then they look at the current serum, and they can see that these antibodies have become more prevalent in the more recent serum.
And that has led to a growth in the gluten-free industry.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Although I'm never sure whether somebody actually has celiac disease or not.
Yeah, well, it's pretty easy to test for. I think, I hate to say this, but I think it's become a little bit fashionable, the idea of having a gluten-free diet, as if gluten is this demon all of a sudden. It's really easy to test
for. It is if you have celiac.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. It can cause all sorts of problems like osteoporosis, and you get all sorts of deficiencies because essentially your gut is not absorbing nutrients the way it should.
Have we seen a similar growth of these disorders in other countries?
Well, that's the interesting part is no. Basically, these disorders rise almost exactly commensurate with GDP. And even within countries, some of these disorders, like the allergic disorders, especially in developing world, the sort of the higher your income bracket, the more susceptible you are to let's say, asthma in Africa at this point. That's what they're finding.
But the countries with where people have the highest GDP, like Scandinavian countries, this doesn't seem to be as big a problem.
Yes, it is. It is, absolutely. They have some of the highest type 1 diabetes. Number one country for type 1 diabetes is Finland. Multiple sclerosis sort of rampant, and they're just as allergic as pretty much everyone else, which is...
Do autoimmune diseases affect women more frequently than men?
Yes, they do. That's sort of a mystery, but one really interesting explanation for that is that women actually have a superior immune system because they have less testosterone. And so they don't get this natural immune suppressant. And you can sort of see this in the fact that women always outlive men. They just generally have a better ability to fight off, in theory, infections, but that also may backfire in the modern-day environment.
My guest is Moises Velasquez-Manoff, who's covered science and environment for the Christian Science Monitor and has also written for the New York Times Magazine, Chicago Tribune, and other publications. His book, The Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases, is published by Scribner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you looked into the latest research, and that's into how the elimination of certain microbes and parasites from our environment in which we've created a cleaner world is actually having a negative impact on
that's
our
right.
lives?
I just want to be clear on one thing. The vaccines have nothing to do with the kind of organisms we're talking about. Vaccines are good because they deal with organisms that basically don't help our immune systems, the measles and so on. Those infections are not the kind of infections we're talking about. The kind we're talking about are the microbes that live sort of permanently in our intestinal tract, number one. Some of the infections may be in our tissue, tuberculosis, even though I wouldn't say we want to go and all regain tuberculosis at this point. But there are some really interesting studies showing that it prevents allergic disease. And then there are the parasites.
Go ahead.
Well, the parasites, you have a very unique reaction to them because you said there are these huge animals that invade your body, and you can't over-respond to them. And you sort of know that from millions of years of coevolution. So what happens is you tightly control all the inflammation in your body when you come in contact with a parasite. I'm being very sort of general here, but that's what happens. And that control ends up tamping down on other inflammatory diseases.
So antibiotics could play a major role in creating this situation. When we kill the bad bacteria, we're also killing the good bacteria. When we kill the bad parasites, we're also killing the good parasites.
That's right. Absolutely.
So if I have a worm in my body, it might be doing some good?
In theory, yes. Where we want to end up is with parasites that are doing all good and doing no bad, because sort of the wild parasites also harm you a little bit. They're taking stuff from you.
Now, there have always been hay fever, celiac disease, Crohn's disease. People have been allergic ever since at least I've been alive. So is there just more of it now?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's allergic disease has tripled in the developed world, more or less, including asthma, hay fever, eczema, and autoimmune disorders, depending on which one you look at, they've gone up even by much more. Some of them, inflammatory bowel disease, in northerly countries where these diseases seem to strike much more, it's sometimes quintupled, sometimes it's tenfold. I mean, it depends on the population you're looking at.
As part of your research, you infected yourself with hookworm?
That's correct.
Why?
Just curiosity. And also I thought, I mean, if someone is telling you, if all the science is suggesting that it's possible that you could send some or all of these strange disorders you have into remission, my gut instinct as a journalist is go check it out. And so I went and checked, literally my gut instinct, since they end up in your gut. I went and checked it out. And
well, is this legal? Can you just go to a doctor and say, get me a hookworm. I want to swallow it.
Not yet. Maybe soon. But right now there's this sort of underground movement where people have read the science, found it compelling. And I mean, so I want to make sure I separate these two things. There's an underground movement and there's also legitimate science going on at real institutions looking into hookworm as a treatment. I went to the underground, which is in this case, Tijuana, Mexico. So these guys just essentially got their own hookworm larvae from a wild human population, in quotes, and now they grow it, and meaning that they have the colony within themselves, and they cultivate their own larvae from their own eggs.
But you still have alopecia, so
that's right.
Didn't cure it.
No, not at all. But there was some interesting sort of peach fuzz regrowth, which you can still see if you dare to get close enough.
Maybe during the break. Where did the idea of treating autoimmune disorders with worms even come from? It seems totally far out to me.
Well, it came from people who understand these disorders. They understand how the immune system seems to be unbalanced, and they also understand the very particular response to a parasite. And they put two and two together, and they noticed that the response to a parasite is exactly the response that's needed to fix the autoimmune disorder.
Are there populations where we're likely to find hookworm or other kinds of worms in most people? And if that's the case, are they less likely to suffer from autoimmune disorders?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the observations that sort of led to this research.
So where in the world are allergies and autoimmune disorders rare?
In the developing world, in people that are carrying lots of parasites. I visited one population in South America, actually.
There are people who believe that just letting kids play in dirt is good for them, that when we use all these antibiotic soaps, we're actually causing trouble for our children down the line.
I think that's that the science is going to demonstrate that more and more. I think playing in the dirt is absolutely fine. Whether it's going to fix anything, I'm not so sure, because regular dirt in, say, Central Park may not contain the microbes that are important.
On the other hand, those populations may not have the disorders we're talking about, like asthma and eczema, but they suffer from other illnesses and
that's right.
Some pretty terrible ones.
Yeah, I mean, infant mortality in the Chimani, who I visited, they live in the Bolivian Amazon. It's somewhere, you know, it's between 20% and 30%. Well, actually, it's less now that they're getting vaccines and they have access to medicine. But that was sort of a constant throughout human evolution. And I'm not saying at all that we need to go back to this horrible infant mortality where, you know, basically between one of every four children born or one of every five children born was gone. You just sort of, everyone accepted that in the first year. I mean, it's a terrible thing to think about, especially nowadays.
My guest is Moises Velasquez-Manoff. His book, An Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases, published by Scribner. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with an interview I did in October with Moises Velasquez-Manoff. His book, An Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases, is published by Scribner. I asked him, when humans moved from a hunter-gatherer way of life to agricultural societies, did that alter our exposure to parasites, bacteria, and other pathogens?
To pathogens, yes, and probably to parasites as well. When people are living in large concentrated groups, the parasite exposure goes up because basically of the sewer problem, and you know people haven't been necessarily very good at dealing with that, and so basically all these things are oral fecal in the sense that they come out one end and they go in the next person's, you know, the front end,
and that this was a problem with cities as they developed.
Absolutely, I mean it's amazing. You see, actually, there are these studies on height, on human height, that go all the way back to, if you piece them together, to the late Paleolithic, and you see people getting tall. They're very tall in the Paleolithic. They get short when they settle down. Actually, they start getting shorter in late Paleolithic. Evidence of crowding, more pathogens, less food. They start suffering from sort of anemia that you can see in the bones, and then they get tall again when they disperse. You know, after the fall of the Roman Empire, for example, these terrific studies on how the Romans, once they started eking a living from the land, once this huge civilization fell apart, essentially everyone went back to the country, they got taller again. And the Romans were actually shorter than everyone else who lived in Central Europe when they moved there. So you see this, you see the effect of the pathogen load and the parasite load in stature throughout human history.
And how do we tell what kinds of parasites and diseases people once had?
That's hard to tell. Nowadays they can find molecular evidence of it. A great overlooked field of parasitology is paleoparasitology, which is essentially looking at coprolites, which are it's fossilized human feces, and you can see what parasites everyone had by looking at that.
When did common ailments like hay fever, a pollen allergy, start appearing? Does that go back very early?
I'm sure that some people have always had hay fever, but the first sort of population-wide reports of hay fever in the late 19th century, first in the UK, then the US.
Charles Blackley determined the cause.
That's right, by inhaling pollen and sneezing all over the place.
Because
he had hay fever.
But some of us can inhale a lot of pollen. I can, and
yeah,
I have no allergic reaction. Somebody else just walks into a park and starts sneezing like mad.
Yeah, that's exactly the question. Why are some people sensitive and what some people aren't? And why have the group of people who are more sensitive, why has that group grown? And one answer is your immune system has not been educated correctly.
Even if it's something that we've lived with all our throughout human history, like pollen or like pets.
That's right.
I knew somebody who knew immediately when she crossed the threshold that the person inside had a cat.
Yeah, well, I'm like that as well. My lungs slam shut. My eyes start swelling. I love cats, but I can tell immediately if a cat.
Now, people do develop, or populations do develop resistance to different things. Malaria, for example.
Yeah.
You write about the island of Sardinia off of Italy, which had a history with malaria. And aren't Sardinians genetically different because they've been isolated from the mainland Italians and other Europeans?
Yeah. No one's really sure why they're so isolated, but part of it may be actually because of the malaria, that they sort of, everyone knew the island was malarial. Even in Roman times, people are talking about how sort of pestilential this place is. And wave after wave of people came and sort of set up shop on the island and then left. And no one really made inroads to the center where the actual old Sardinian genome was sitting, getting whittled away at by Plasmodium falciparum, which is the really malignant malaria.
And did multiple sclerosis start appearing there as a way of fighting off the malaria?
Well, the idea is, so this is a hypothesis by this guy, Stefano Sociu, and the idea is that they just noticed that malaria was eradicated after the World War II in the 1950s. It was basically—
That late.
Yeah, that late, very well into the 20th century. And then almost immediately thereafter, I guess type 1 diabetes, which it's like number 2 in the world for type 1 diabetes, and then multiple sclerosis just start climbing and climbing and climbing to levels. It's one place in the world where it's these things are among the highest ever.
So malaria might have been staving off these other illnesses, or at least the body's reaction to it. An interesting alternative is what happens with sickle cell anemia.
That's
isn't
right,
it?
Which also exists there among the population. You can actually see, not sickle cell, but other adaptations. They vary by the height, that is the elevation on the island, because there is sort of a mountainous area. The more common down in the lowlands and less common up high.
But sickle cell is more common in Africa, where malaria has been a problem as well.
Yes, that's correct.
Can you talk about Dr. Joel Weinstock's research into Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory bowel disorder?
Yeah, well, we were talking earlier about how people put this together. He was one of the people who put this together. And what's remarkable about this story is that different people around the world are putting the parasites together with various immune-mediated disorders. But his observation was that he was familiar with parasites, he was familiar with inflammatory bowel disease, and that parasites induce a reaction in the gut that is exactly the opposite of what the problem is in inflammatory bowel disease. They skew the immune response the other way, towards presumably something that's curative.
And he came up with the idea that pig whip worm larvae might be beneficial in treating Crohn's and other autoimmune disorders?
Yeah.
Where are pig whip worm larvae
so
found?
They're found in pigs. He was in Iowa, which is, I think, number one or number two pig-producing state in the country. And he observed that pig farmers were probably colonized with this all the time, and they never reported any problems with it. And he wanted an organism that would not replicate inside a human, because that's the last thing you want. We spent a lot of time and money in this country getting rid of parasites in the early 20th century. You don't want to sort of reintroduce them back into the population.
We spoke to Dr. Weinstock on the show a couple of years ago. Is his research into therapeutic parasites catching on?
Yeah, there's a company now based out of Germany that sort of developed a process for safely producing the eggs. They get these miniature Danish pigs, if I'm remembering correctly. They keep them hyper clean. They have this whole thing worked out, and they have approval from their version of the FDA. That is good manufacturing process approval.
And what is what do the larvae do? Because obviously, this is not a new thing. The man found mummified in a glacier in the Alps was infected with whipworm, wasn't
he?
Yeah,
that's right. Otzi the Iceman, he had human whipworm.
Uh-huh.
He's 5,300 years old. So we know that we had those parasites by then. We know we had them much.
So they were causing one kind of problem, but protecting us against other things.
Yeah. Well, it's more that you have to just think that the human immune system is actually optimized to operate correctly in the presence of parasite infection. So it's sort of, it's one of the very influences, the very many different types of influences.
But to some degree, is this like getting a shot, a vaccine, and the body then builds up antibodies so that we don't catch the illness later down the line?
It'd be very nice if they could make a vaccine that would do something like this. But it's different in the sense that what it's doing is strengthening your ability to tolerate. It's strengthening what's called the regulatory circuitry in your body. So that a vaccine actually does sort of the opposite. It's training your immune system to recognize something and fight it off immediately. So if they can figure out a vaccine that strengthens this regulatory circuitry. And one thing to note about parasites is the when you get colonized by one, it's long-term. So it takes a sort of, you know, years-long residence in your body. So you constantly have this influence.
Should I assume I have some worms in my body?
You could find out very easily. I don't think you should assume that, though.
Moises Velasquez Manoff's book, An Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases, is published by Scribner. And last month, you published an op-ed piece in the New York Times about new research into the causes of autism that showed possible connections between inflammatory diseases in the mother. Can you explain?
Yeah, so there's this remarkable body of research by various groups around the country and really around the world showing that one way toward sort of producing autism is that there's some sort of immune imbalance in the mother. And I think that it really stemmed from observations of natural phenomena where mothers who were infected, for example, I think in 1964 with the rubella virus, there was this pandemic, and their kids had a much higher chance of developing autism. And I think the assumption was always that the virus infected the fetus. But more recent work shows that it's just the immune response, the attempt at repelling the invader that then interferes with fetal development.
But rubella, not other illnesses.
Well, you have a very, very strong immune response to rubella. And actually also probably...
Well, it's easy. Our bodies don't have... I mean, rubella is what German measles, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And that's probably one of the most benign illnesses a kid can have.
It was the mothers who had this, not the kids, while they were pregnant.
So that's when it becomes a real problem.
That's right. Just sort of an inflammation.
So what might cause immune system dysregulation in utero?
Well, the maternal risk factors are at this point, according to the studies, autoimmune diseases in the mother, asthma and allergies, according to at least one study, and infection. So these are all the different possibilities, the causal possibilities for dysregulation.
And you cite a population-wide Danish study. What did it reveal?
Well, there was two of them. One was autoimmune disease was a risk factor, particularly celiac disease and rheumatoid arthritis, if I remember correctly. And the other was that infection with the flu and just some, there were some bacterial infections, just common even UTIs possibly.
Does a woman with an inflammatory autoimmune disorder like celiac disease or asthma have an increased likelihood of giving birth to a child with autism?
Yes, but I think the important point to make is that the overall likelihood is still very small. So it may be double or triple. But so if we look at now it's 1 in 88, maybe it doubles to, that's not quite right, but it's still very small.
Are autoimmune disorders usually genetic? Do fathers pass them on as frequently as mothers?
Yes, everyone has them equally. But the question with this autism issue is if there's some sort of immune dysregulation going on. I mean, your life starts in the womb. This body of science that started on the margins and now has become more mainstream, but the conditions in the womb shape your sort of outcome for the rest of your life.
If a pregnant woman who doesn't suffer from significant allergy spends time on a farm around animals and pollens and microbes in the soil, would that help prevent allergies in her offspring?
Possibly. The thing to make sure to point out there is that these people that observation comes from farming populations and mostly in Central Europe. They were working on the farm before they got pregnant. So they already sort of had this chronic exposure.
But what if they already had allergies to those things? Would that have a negative effect on the offspring?
If they had allergies to, say, a horse dander or something? Possibly, yes. What those studies reveal, though, is that it's possible to sort of prevent that first of all, that allergy begins in the womb, right? That sort of the lack of exposure, of microbial exposures of your mother, or the right microbial exposures, leaves your immune system a little bit skewed towards the allergic response.
A listener, Alejandro from Cambridge, wrote in with a question. He said, my 6-year-old son has off-the-charts allergies to wheat, soy, eggs, nuts, and tree nuts. We know that these test results are not all false positives because he unfortunately had an anaphylactic event. To which allergen, though, we still do not know. I'm interested in learning more about what new research is being done into improving allergy testing methods, from general probabilities of reaction towards more relevant tests that include severity of reaction as well.
That's interesting. I would say there's some really interesting work on getting rid of these allergies now with oral immunotherapy. So the old way was sort of you do shots, but they sometimes provoke the very reaction that they were seeking to cure, which is this huge anaphylactic shock reaction. Now they're doing oral immunotherapy, which is basically you take a very minuscule amount of whatever it is that you're allergic to and just build up very slowly over the course of a year. It takes
a long
time.
It's almost like homeopathy.
Exactly. It is exactly like that. I think those guys were on to something.
We did a Please Explain segment on the Human Microbiome Project in June. Will that research help shed some light on the role that microbes living on or in our bodies help regulate our immune system?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's the amazing thing about this research. It's, you know, it's $150 million that NIH has put into just understanding what's there. And we're really at the beginning of even sort of quantifying the various organisms that live in and on us. So we will be able to marshal this knowledge eventually, but not quite yet.
But introducing parasites, worms especially, may be totally unappealing to some people.
Yeah.
Even the idea that the healthy human body should be teeming with billions of microbes may make some people feel a bit queasy. Do we need to adjust our way of thinking about our bodies and how our immune system should work?
Yes, I think we do. I mean, I think people who worry about the microbes on their bodies should stop worrying because they're already there. It's not like they're going to get them. They're there already. It's just we hope they're the right ones.
Do you think that we're going to come up with cures to these, to autoimmune problems fairly soon?
I think that we'll eventually prevent them. I think that's much easier than dealing with.
The book, An Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Allergies and Autoimmune Diseases, published by Scribner. Thank you so much.
Thank you.